Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
Hi, my name is Jamie Roberts.
And I'm Robert Lendrum.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the movies that had you running away but coming back for more.
What is going on, Rob? How you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling way better. It's been a tough week because, as you know, work has been crazy for me. I work in sports and like every league is getting ready to go. I work on hockey. And so we've been busting our ass trying to get that going. So, I've been having some long work weeks lately and just haven't been able to put the time back to Running Scared that I want to. And, but finally, this is good to sit down and I'm excited because we got a good one tonight. But let's do a little chat first, Jane. How are you doing, man?
I'm good, man. You know, for me, you definitely get used to not working for a living, and I'm a teacher, so I work part-time. so I've been back at work, and I got my grade 8 class and you know, feeling good about that. Oh, my God.
You
know
what?
For all those out there that have, teenagers, 13, 14, you are sending them to me. and I'm teaching them. No, I've been teaching grade 8 for a decade. I've got a great group of kids. I actually have some kids that are some horror fans and some thriller fans. They want to talk movies and they want to talk music. So it's fantastic. But
well,
that wasn't
the high. They think they're the kings of the school, eh? Because they're the
kings. They are the kings of the school, right? You know, and I've been in a middle school and then I've been in a K-8 school. And in the middle school, they really feel like they kind of run things, right? Because it's like a mini high school before they get to the big, right. to the big place. But that definitely wasn't the highlight. I got a quick story for you, Rob. Mm-hmm. So my wife, her aunt, very generous woman, she's renovating her kitchen and she is giving her stove away. We decided we're going to take it. So what I do is I rent a truck and it's Saturday, I think last week, pick up the truck, 8 o'clock in the morning. If anybody out there's rented anything lately, the costs are exorbitant. You know, we can thank Amazon for that. It's like ridiculous. I remember, you know, you get the deals, U-Haul, $49.99, sign it away. Yeah, those days are gone.
Those are Canadian numbers, by the way. American listeners might be like, that is expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Canuck money here. So I go and I take the budget. So I get the budget van, the cargo van, much bigger than I needed, but I take it up to Guelph. Guelph is a city in Ontario for those that maybe don't know. We're coming from Hamilton. So anyways, I go get the stove. I come back and I have to come back to my house and then I take the stove out. And then I take the original stove and I didn't have a gas fitter. I had to call my father-in-law. He came down and he unhooked the stove. We brought it down, scrap metal. It was, you know, Kijiji, thank you. It was out of my life in like a matter of minutes. So then I'm frantic because I need to be somewhere at 1:30. Okay. I've got something to do. So this is taking me all morning. So what I do is finish the job. I go down to jump in the van and I'm going to go back down to the downtown area to return the van. Okay. Go in there. I give the keys back. I give the insurance back. We do a circle check as we always do. No dents. And then I reach into my pocket and realize that I forgot the keys to my car.
So the car is parked there?
So the car is literally right beside the van that I just brought in. And what do? This is the Running Scared Podcast. I put on a fucking jog cast and I ran home.
I had no idea where this was going. I was like, oh, this is a branding message. I didn't know this was an advertisement. That's hilarious.
Well, it's half branding message, half like I ran home. I'm, you know. Anybody that listens to us, we talk about running. We do jog casts here. So it's kind of like a little bit of self-promotion. But the fact is I love to run. That's what I do. I like to go and run. I played soccer my whole life. So I ran home. So I've got I've got my wallet. I've got my phone. I've got my headphones in. And then my wife is there and she's like, she just like is perplexed. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like sweating. I've got like a button-up shirt on. I said, I just ran home. She's like, you're fucking nuts. So I grab my keys and I book it back. And in my mind, and any runner out there will just attest to this, I just got in my 8K because it was 4K up to my house and then 4K down. Anybody that lives in Hamilton knows that everything's close. Anyways, that was my story. My story of the week.
I rented a van when I lived in Montreal for a long time. I rented a van to get back to Toronto. And those streets are so narrow, right? And we got this huge ass freaking van. It was me and a buddy moving out. And I swear, I offloaded my apartment in like an hour. I took up maybe 1/10 of this van. He and his girlfriend filled the rest of the van to the point that we were like there at 4 o'clock when the bus lane was opening. So we had to get out of the lane that we were parked in. And he's just throwing shit in the back of this van at this point now. We're just like throwing it in because we're like, we got to go. He's leaving shit behind. He's just like, ah, fuck it. I don't care. As I drive on these narrow ass streets, I make a right-hand turn and I don't even think much of it. I was like, cool, keep going. And this car comes chasing me and he finds me because we had to stop. And he chases me, parks beside me. He's like, hey, you motherfucker, you fucking hit my car. I'm like, what are you talking about? I didn't hit your car. I think I would have noticed if I hit your car. He goes, look at this. And he points and he shows me I've scraped the side of his car like across it. And I'm like, what? I couldn't even hear it because this freaking cube van was so big. And I caught him on my back, like my back right tire. As I did the right, I just scraped the shit out of his car as I drove by. And I didn't even hear it. And I was like, oh, dude, I'm so sorry. I look back on my truck and there's the paint from his car all over it. And I'm like, sorry, dude.
Rob, you shouldn't be telling me this. This is just another black mark on your driving record.
Honestly, I think that is the last thing. And that would be 2007. That's the last thing I've had with my cars, like in terms of accidents. But, you know, it wasn't, insurance actually wrote it off and it was covered because I bought insurance when I got the van. So I was all good.
That's really smart. For like an extra $30, you get the insurance. But just anyways, for when I say black mark for Rob and his driving, for anybody out there, Rob, myself, and our good friend of the podcast, Michael Yokota. What's up? What's up, Yik?
Hasn't listened to one yet.
Rob, but he was a guest speaker on Jogcast too, I believe, right? We killed him off quick.
Yeah, we got killed.
But Rob, you got us into 3 car accidents in one weekend.
Like, they were very minor.
That's a record.
I was 17 and I haven't had one since, except for that scraping.
Scraping, right? But anyways, yeah. So there's our story with the vans, but, anyways, it's like, well, you know, what a world, right? You know, just getting back, I think the craziness, and that was 2007, but the van story for me, just getting back into, you know, this coming out of COVID, getting back to work, leaving the house, going back into the office. It's just an interesting time, right? And the movie we're talking about now, I think, is just that kind of warm, comfy blanket of horror that we love, you know what I mean? So what movie are we doing tonight?
Well, we're doing something special. We're actually doing 2 movies, although what it is it's we're doing a movie and its remake. So tonight we're reviewing Fright Night 1985 as well as Fright Night 2011, the remake. Why did we choose Fright Night? Jamie, I have a personal connection to this movie. I think you do too. So I'd love to hear yours. But okay, so Fright Night, I think, might be the first horror movie I ever saw. 85 means I'm about 6 years old when it comes out. And I remember distinctly my brother Zeus. He's my stepbrother. That's why he has a cool name and I have a boring name. Him and my brother Sam are in the basement. We start watching Fright Night and my parents like let us do it. They're like, okay.
Is Roger down there? Is Roger there too?
No, this is when we're younger because Zeus would like 10. So he's like 10 watching this. And he's the oldest one. So our parents are like, okay, it's going to be a scary movie though. So be careful. Like, it might give you nightmares. And we're like, no, we're fine. So my 2 brothers are watching this with me. I'm downstairs and I can't remember exactly what scene it was. I feel like it was when evil is changed and we first see him. I was so freaking petrified. Actually, no, it has to be earlier because I remember being so uncomfortable as a little kid, right? And I think there's some nudity pretty early in the movie, or there's like some.
Yeah, like in typical 80s fashion.
Yeah.
Like they hit it and hit it hard.
So I'm like, I remember watching from the top of the stairs and peeking down to like watch the movie because I was so bashful about the idea that there was naked ladies. And then the when evil transforms into the sort of vampire werewolf thing, whatever he is, I had a full out like, oh my God. And I was scared senseless. I had a nightmare that night about evil. And it's right up there with this is a weird one for some people. They think this is hilarious. But I remember watching Thriller for the first time as a kid, like Michael Jackson's Thriller. Yeah. And that scared the shit out of me. I think Thriller is 1983. So I'm only like four when that comes out. I remember my sister and my mom showing it to me. I'm hiding behind the couch during that thing. I was petrified. And this movie, I don't know why. I guess there is some actual, like, you know, kind of visual style linkage between the two, the 85 Fright Night and Michael Jackson's Thriller. But, like, man, these two things scared the hell out of me. And the other thing, Jamie, I am also holding in my hand right now an issue of Fright Night, the comic, number one from Now Comics. This was published in, I'm a big comic fan. I don't know how I still have this. This was published in 1988. This is a recap of the movie. I only have the first issue here, but it's very loyal to the movie, and it has a backstory that was a unique story. And so the idea was that the comic would retell the movie, and then they had these backstories where they were going to tell new adventures of Peter and Charlie. So yeah, it's actually a
pretty, did it take off? Like did.
It published over 20 issues. And like I said, they got through the recap of the actual movie in the first two. So basically 20 unique Fright Night stories unrelated to the movie. I don't know about the sequel because there is a Fright Night sequel to the 1985 film.
Yeah, there is. The 88 came out.
Yeah, and there's a sequel to the 2011, by the way. It looks like a straight to DVD kind of thing.
Yeah, we'll forget about that.
Yeah, we're not doing the sequels here,
maybe,
folks.
Maybe Mateo's in that one.
Maybe he gets killed first. Anyway, the comic is pretty good, and it's very story-wise loyal, and as well as like all the beats are there too. Like, you know, Charlie meets the girl who goes in for the date, goes into the vampire's house, like outside the cab, and you know, his girlfriend throws the sandwich in his face, and when he sees it, she's been killed. And
was it like a continuous, like a, you know, like a sitcom would be? No, not a sitcom, but like, you know, a drama where it kind of continues the story, or was each episode its own story that kind of had a start and finish, and then it moved on to something different on the next episode?
Yeah, I don't know. I have a feeling it was episodic like that. I think it all took place post Fright Night 1, but it was episodic in nature, where, you know, where it's kind of like a monster of the week kind of story.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. You know what, for me, my introduction to this is, I remember staying at my grandparents' house down at, you know, down in their apartment at Jane and Shepherd, you know, anybody that knows Toronto, right? And I loved horror films, and, you know, they're immigrants from Scotland, and they would take me down to the video. Actually, we would go down to Sheridan Plaza. Like, I was young. I was 6, 7 years old, right, when this movie first came out. So it had been a couple of years on the shelf, but as young as 7 or 8, you know, my grandparents would babysit my cousin Ryan and myself. And, you know, we'd go down to Sheridan Plaza, and then we'd jump over to the byway, get some shoes. Then we'd go down to the donut shop. I'd get a chocolate glaze, and then we'd end up going over to the video shop. And my grandmother would just, you know, she would say something like, "All right, son, now you select something. You select something.
If it's no Scottish, it's crap."
And I remember looking just like, you know, like a kid in a candy store, thinking to myself, fucking hell, the Fright Night cover on the 1985 was so fucking badass. That and House, you know, that finger.
Yeah, it's the finger.
Ding dong, you're dead.
Yeah. Ding dong, you're dead. Yeah.
Ding dong, you're dead. That was like the subtext, right?
What a great caption.
Yeah, really amazing. So, you know, Ryan and I were picking like Fright Night or Friday the 13th or whatever. But I remember, anyways, one night we picked this movie, and, you know, we brought it up to the apartment, and I, in fair play, I was like probably a little bit older, but we'd sit there, we put it on, and you know what? I was probably a bit too young to be watching the movies, but I was there with my grand and papa, and it was friggin' fantastic. And I was scared shitless, because these movies for like a young kid were pretty, like you said, there was nudity, there's a lot of gore in this film first off, right? And there's a lot of kind of gratuitous violence later on, and
you know, it's not that bad, but I know what you mean. Like,
like
the monsters are like, the vampires become very monstrous.
Oh, there's green slime, there's, yeah, like, the, you slime. Know But we can get into that afterwards. But anyways, that for me, that's what I remember. And so to bring it full circle and to make less of a joke of it, why this movie, I love it because it's like, you know, it's a classic. It's a cult classic. It's probably a popular classic, a mainstream hit. But for me, it actually is a nice memory of my grandparents. And I, you know what I mean? Like I was close with them and they passed on pretty early in my life. So when we did this and we wanted to do that, I was pretty excited because, you know, I miss them and it makes me think of them in a really nice light. And so I'm kind of channeling that vibage into this podcast tonight.
That's cool, man. That's nice. I mean, I'm not laughing at that. I'm just laughing at the idea of like, of all movies, this is the one that connects you with your grandparents. And like, it is such it's kind of a crappy B movie, but you know, it did well.
No, this was like the second or third highest grossing horror film of the year.
Oh.
It made a lot of money. Like it made like 25, 30 million. Yeah. And like think of it, 1985, right? If you know, you want to prorate that to dollars in today's world,
mm-hmm.
this would have been a high, you know, this was a successful movie and it was a great movie. There's a lot of really, really good elements to it.
So Jamie, the reason we're doing both is that, you know, I don't know, these movies are a little bit easy. I would say they're kind of simple.
Just like Hereditary.
Yeah, well, let's not talk about that. Boy, me and Jamie are still wrestling with Hereditary. Like we watched it, we potted it. We're not even sure what I watched
it. So I watched it again.
Yeah, I've watched it twice too.
It's interesting. So for me, it was like my fifth view, but I watched it again. I feel like I want to do a podcast redux on what we did later on, but let's leave that there.
Yeah. So anyways. Point being, folks, we watched Hereditary. We were about to knock that one out and we weren't impressed with our recording and we're sort of like, man, this movie is so challenging. Maybe we just need to breathe on it a bit more.
Yeah.
So that's why we were like, well, let's go to the light one that we want to do, which is Fright Night. And then as we watched this, we both like ate up the first one so quickly. And then I said, yo, Jamie, Fright Night, the remake is on Disney Plus. Like, why don't we watch that too?
Yeah.
And I have to say it is bad, but I am not disappointed by it. I think it was pretty fun and we'll get into that why, but holy cow, man. Like, there's something about these movies to me that, strike this weird balance of like super fun, kind of scary, kind of silly. And I pose the question to you, Jamie. I mean, 1985, we're too young to know this, but 2011, we could figure this out. Were these date movies?
I thought about that. Were they date movies? Were they kind of like teen drama movies?
Yeah.
You know what I think? I think definitely the 2011 version was somehow trying to pick up the scraps off the whole Twilight series. And you know, to me, it felt like you were still kind of like there was a beating heart that was just kind of like on its last legs a little bit with the 2011 version of that.
In terms of the popularity of vampires, is that what you mean?
I think the popularity of the vampires, the fact that it was set with teenagers, that's one of the things I wanted to mention that I thought was actually quite different between the two movies is that the 2011 version just has a younger cast. When you think about Peter Vincent, when you think about Jerry the vampire, they're cast younger, or at least they look younger. So I think...
Well, it's interesting you say that.
Yeah.
You're talking about the other characters because the story still circulates. Both stories are high school students.
They're high school students, but some of those secondary characters are younger, which makes it look a little bit, makes it maybe feel a little bit more current, a little bit more fresh.
For sure.
I think these movies are date movies. I think these movies are comedy movies. I think probably the latter film, you know what? I would say both movies are still accessible for if you're taking your girlfriend out or you're taking your partner out, whoever, or even if you're going with a group of guys or a group of girls to just enjoy it. I think horror invites lots of different, you know, kind of iterations of groupings to come and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And kind of like, that's the beauty of horror is that
it's fun to watch with people.
It's definitely fun to watch with people. In fact, just the last, many of the episodes that we do, we always talk about some of them, like when we went to go see it together, right? You know, you'll take your wife, I'll go with my, you know what I mean? We'll just go see it together because it's fun. So is that a date night for us or is that like a group outing?
Well, we're older, that's the thing. But my point is like, they both are like these romance / horror movies, right? And they really do sort of ring this bell for like, they're all about titillation, both of them. I have more problems with the 2011 in terms of like, you know, as a female, I can't put myself in the, but if I try to put myself in the mindset of a female audience, I find like 2011 is a little more curt. Or what's the word I'm looking for? Like, they're a little too like jockey. The way the scripts are written are a bit too like leaning into the dude culture a bit too much.
Absolutely.
Just the way that women are described and treated by people. However, at the same time, they're both kind of fun. And I think like, the female characters are able to stand up to a lot of that bullshit in the movie, but at the same time, like it's there. Let's get into it actually, because let's talk about how Chris Sarandon, who plays Jerry in the 1985 film, is such a like, he's like unconventionally handsome, slick and attractive, and he's a seducer in a like very, what's the word I'm looking for? Like he's
I think it's like I think it's two things. It's a very classic vampire Lestat kind of way, right?
Yeah.
Where it's
he mesmerizes the women.
Absolutely, right? And it's not so much like he comes across as somehow exotic, somehow schooled, somehow just the way he carries himself. He's always put together, right?
Yeah.
And you know, and that's really interesting when you look at the way that Colin Farrell presents himself, right?
Right.
He's like a handyman, a fucking carpenter.
No, he's a construction worker.
Or a construction worker.
Concrete.
Okay. Okay. But still like a tradesman, a laborer, right? Which is interesting from that point because there's, you know, that exotic appeal.
Yeah. He's supposed to look thirsty for the women. Like he's supposed to look like this hot, like construction worker guy.
Even from the viewer, like even from a male female viewer looking at it. Right. I was absolutely far more interested in Chris Sarandon's, you know, his take on the character, right. The way he, and like the casting there, right. Just even the way that he's got the leather jacket and the way he eats the apple and just, and his eyes actually. One last family note is this Chris Sarandon, he looks a hell of a lot like my Uncle Les with that kind of voluminous brown hair that, you know, is kind of flowy. And, you know, he's got your favorite thing. He's got the Cosby sweater that he wears when he goes to the nightclub. But he's very, it's a tale of two versions of him. In the first half of the film, in the 1985 version, he's like a very controlled, you know, guy next door kind of character, but definitely with just, you know, enveloped with intrigue for everybody around him. Right. And then in the second half, you know, clearly all hell breaks loose and he's in his house and he shows his true colors with his vampiring. But yeah, I think like is it close, or you know what I mean? Is it closer? Is which one do you prefer?
The point I was driving towards though is that like he's a seducer. He's elegant in a way, and like
absolutely,
he makes you step forward to him. He's like a passive trap instead of an active hunter, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
And Colin Farrell is like the rapiest dude you've ever met in your life. This guy's a scumbag through and through. So that's like a really, I thought, strange choice, but. You know, in a way it clarifies who's evil in this movie. Whereas I think Chris Sarandon plays the role in a way that you're like, I don't even know if he's a bad guy. Like he's killing people, but he's a vampire. He needs to get blood. So otherwise he seems kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to, like you said, you want to like him at the beginning of the film, right? You know, because Charlie's snooping on him, and especially when he comes into the house and Charlie comes in and the chair is turned around the other way and you can't see who's in the chair, and the mom is talking to him and like, Charlie, this is our new neighbor. Mm-hmm. And he turns around and it seems like, oh, he's a great guy. He's super nice. And Charlie's the one that's kind of like, you know, is making all these accusations, these assumptions about him. Clearly turns out to be true. But for me, I could never understand. Well, you know what? I'm going to stop myself there. We're talking about really in the 1985 version, Jerry, there's a whole excellent character arc. There's a great character development of him. And the fact that we can even just kind of just, you know, riff off it really quickly shows that there's a lot of meat on the bone. The Colin Farrell version, I didn't really, to me, it seemed like it was pretty 2D. Like,
oh, yeah. Like, he goes from bad to horrible.
But he's a shithead at the beginning.
Yeah, like, he's bad at the beginning and just gets worse. He doesn't really like, basically all you learn is that he's even worse than you thought.
Like he's not nice, and he's not trying to, you know, it's interesting that Toni Collette's the mother, eh, in that one, after doing Hereditary, and Collette's the one that is like playing the role of as Charlie's mother from the, you know, from the original one and in this one. But he doesn't strike a chord with me the same way that Sarandon does. And also just the way that he's presented on screen, you know what I mean? It's, you know, it's just a little bit different, right? Mm-hmm. I don't feel like Colin Farrell has, honestly, just like the physical presence that the other one did, you know? And just, yeah. I think with the way the filming was, the way the shot was, it makes me think, was Colin Farrell even like the right, you know, was he the right actor to play the role?
Oh, do you not think, like, I'm a superhero fan, but don't you think like Colin Farrell is just like doing his best Wolverine impression here to be like, hey, you guys, like Hugh Jackson's got to retire soon, right? How about me? What about me, guys? I want that role.
he wants to jump in. Yeah, I guess he's got to find his way. You know, he's like, he's an actor looking for his something, right? I feel like he's gotten a little bit lost in his career. But for me, I don't see, you're right. Like, I just don't see a lot of development with it. I don't see that he's, doesn't deliver the lines as like slick and like you said, elegant, mellifluously. And I don't know. And I never felt under his spell at all. You know what I mean?
Back to date movies, Jamie, just want to talk about that, because what I mean by that date movie thing is like, it's always fun, like you said, to go with your girl and like watch a movie. Like, you know, she's grabbing your arm when she gets scared and all that. And these movies are so, both of these movies are kind of dumb. So they're fun to laugh at. They're fun to like laugh with. They're fun to like, you know, occasionally they actually do scare you. Although I didn't find myself too scared in either of these now, which is funny because I was so petrified by these as a kid, or at least the original. And I just didn't have too many of those like shock scares really. Like they all just seemed like you could see my mile coming, especially in the 85 one. But there is this like feeling of like, the movie is all about Charlie and his girl. Like, why are we together? And are we going to get together? And, you know, of course, in the second one, it's all framed around, are they going to have sex? And, but it sort of reignites that same feeling with you and whoever your partner you're watching it with. Cause you're like, it sort of titillates you in this like kind of high school way. Anyway, so I just think like this idea that like the vampire is trying to steal your girl and you're trying to fight to keep her. And
it's not even that. In this, it's the vampire that's trying to take your girl, right? But I think it's a metaphor for just hold on to your woman. The first scene in, or hold on to your man, or hold on to your partner, or hold on, treat them right. You know, the first scene is Charlie and his girlfriend, and like she's upset because she's willing to, you know, give herself and then and like it's just distracted. Like it's like what a total like, oh my god, it's like a total like misogynist scene, and then she, it's just ridiculous. But
well, in the first one, Marcy, like, from Married with Children is like,
yeah, I was gonna say Amanda Burse, yeah, it's like fucking Married with Children, but
she's like offering herself to him and he gets distracted. And like the funny thing to this is like he was, I think moments before that, like kind of going for it. And she's like, hey, no, slow down there, cowboy.
Yeah.
And he gets, you know, he's like, oh,
Jesus,
sorry.
Marcy, we've been at it for 6 months. Like,
yeah, like he's totally pressuring her, like such a douche. So she like slowly like reveals herself and you can see she's like uncomfortable. She's like, okay, I'm.
And he's got the, binoculars.
He's looking at the chick across the street. By the way, I love this scene of at least the introduction to the vampire, the idea of looking at the window. And like at first he's like, oh, hot babe is about to take her shirt off. And then, oh shit, what did I just see? Like, and
some
like
fingers.
Yeah. Like I thought that was such a cool setup. Like what a great, it feels like the movie writes itself from that point, right? Like they just, boom, they hit you with that scene right off the bat.
Yeah.
And the whole movie unrolls from there.
So, okay. So you said, like, is it a date movie? I think it's a movie that's for the cinema, right? It's a movie that's for the movie theater. It's a movie, it's a popcorn film when you get out there and you're, yeah, like it's just, and that's, I think that's why people that like movies and like going to the movie theater love these kind of films, right? Because, you know, you can have a great scare and you can turn away because the plot is right in front of you. It's not overly complicated.
But the film has momentum.
No, absolutely. And you can just enjoy it. It's really enjoyable because it's really good.
Right? It's clicking along scene for scene. Like you're just like every scene is the logical next step from the last scene. It's easy to ride with, you know, like it's fun.
Yeah. So was it a date movie? Who is the target audience, man? I think it was a lot of different types of people. And I think that's why it was successful. Right. And I think because you've got great characters and also you had some really iconic, funny scenes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's just really good parts of the film. And like, I'm mostly alluding to the 1985 version. You know, we'll get into the comparison a little bit later on. But, you know, let's just go through the plot really quick, right? What is this movie about?
You know, Jamie, we often say that the plot sections of our pods are not our favorite. So I've got an idea. How about we introduce a segment where we introduce a little challenge for ourselves? Let's see if we can wrap up the plot in about 60 seconds. That way we're not rambling on and puttering through it. So you're going to go first. You're going to take the 1985 film. I'll go after that with the 2011. So here we go, Jamie. Give me the plot of Fright Night in 60 seconds.
So what we have here is Charlie, the young protagonist, who lives in a suburban town. He is a older high school student, probably a senior, maybe a little bit older. I think he's a senior. Anyways, there's some strange things happening in the house next door. A new person has moved in, Jerry, the antagonist, and Charlie is starting to get a little bit worried and a little bit nervous and to think that he might be a vampire. On a couple of occasions, he's looked over and he's seen Jerry in action seducing women. He's heard screams. So he's definitely been snooping around. It even goes to the point where he walks over and tries to go into the cellar, only to be shooed away by Jerry's henchman, Billy Cole. Charlie even brings in the police to get them to investigate. But, you know, he's sort of quickly laughed off because how outlandish the claims are. Charlie's getting increasingly worried. So he goes to his friend Evil to find some remedies or some ways to repel a vampire. He's given a cross. He's given some garlic. And sure enough, I believe it's that night, Jerry ends up in Charlie's room and said, you know, you've been causing me a lot of problems snooping around. And he tries to kill Charlie. Charlie is only able to get away because he stabs Jerry in the hand. And then Jerry goes and actually destroys Charlie's car. Charlie goes to Peter Vincent to seek some help from the illustrious vampire hunter. And Peter is sort of unwilling to do that. And then after his friends bribe him to come, they actually take a trip to Jerry's house. And at the end, Peter is looking into his mirror, and at this point he's a disbeliever, but then he looks into his mirror and he sees that all the people there cast a reflection except for Jerry. So, you know, Jerry is able to start to pick off Charlie's friends one at a time. He is able to get Evil in an alleyway and turns him into a vampire. And then in what is one of the most iconic scenes, the nightclub scene, the dance scene, he's able to seduce and hypnotize and then eventually abduct Amy, Charlie's girlfriend. So with Jerry having Evil as a vampire and Amy in his clutches and grasps, Charlie is left with no choice but to get Peter and to go to Jerry's house for the final confrontation. What happens is the battle, and Peter right away is, you know, he leaves the house because something happens, and then he gets into a situation with Evil in Charlie's house, and Evil ends up dying. And then Peter comes back to Jerry's house with Charlie, and then they have the battle with the vampire. It basically, you know, Jerry goes through some changes in his appearance. He becomes a bat, and eventually they end up downstairs. And they kill Jerry with sunlight at the end. I guess the sunlight showdown, you would say. So I guess that's the plot. Maybe a little bit longer than 60 seconds, but that sort of gives you the that just gives you the broad strokes on the plot. Okay, Rob, so it's your turn to do the 2011 version. 60 seconds. Let's hear what you got.
Charlie Brewster is your typical teenage white boy living in a new subdivision of Las Vegas, Nevada. He's got a new neighbor, a sweaty, unshaven hunk of a man named Jerry, who even piques his single mom's interest. Charlie's also got an attractive girlfriend who his friends consider to be out of his league. Nevertheless, Charlie is in love and would do anything to keep the relationship going, including disassociating himself from his old best friend, Ed, the school nerd. Ed points out to Charlie that his other friend is missing and he's not the first kid to disappear. Finally, Charlie agrees to investigate with Ed, who pins the blame solely on Charlie's neighbor, whom he insists is a vampire. They argue, split up, and Ed ends up vampire food. When Charlie realizes Ed is missing, he goes through his bedroom and discovers Ed's video files and makes the shocking discovery that Jerry doesn't show up on video, much like how vampires cast no reflections in mirrors. Charlie sneaks into Jerry's home when his other neighbor, a sexy dancer, doesn't leave Jerry's house. He discovers that Jerry has a secret room where he forcibly confines his victims and feeds on them. Charlie tries to escape with the girl, but she goes poof in the sunlight as she has been turned. Charlie tries to enlist the help of Peter Vincent, a Jamie Angel-esque vampire expert who rejects him. Things spiral quickly for Charlie as Jerry and he make it clear that they're on to each other. Jerry tries to blow up Charlie's house along with his mom and girlfriend. They escape by car, but Jerry follows and injures Charlie's mom. Charlie and Amy escape danger and return to Peter Vincent to solicit his help again. Vincent accidentally invites a delivery man in who turns out to be Vampire Ed. A battle ensues. Peter Vincent runs into his panic room. Charlie and Amy kill Ed, but Jerry has arrived. They run into a Vegas nightclub where they are separated, and Jerry bites Amy. This leads to a final confrontation where Charlie, dressed as Blade, invades Jerry's house. Things are about to go bad as Charlie realizes that Jerry isn't just feeding on teams, he's rebuilding his ranks. Luckily, Peter Vincent arrives to bail him out. Together, they kill Jerry, reverse the spell of all those bitten, including Amy.
Nicely done, Rob. Really nice. So I think we should probably move on to the next segment.
So let's get into the comparison now, Jamie, between these two films, and let's talk about the characters.
That's a plot wrapped up. For, you know, you sold the 2011 version plot as a cranked up, amped up version. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure that's the story that's intended to be told. And again, I want to stay positive because I think there's probably good, well, not probably, there are good things about both movies. But for me, it's like, and I've said this before and I'm going to say it again, and this is where the horror genre kind of, you know, teeters into the action realm when you Michael Bayify shit. And you know what I mean? It doesn't always need to be so over the top. Sometimes things are just better when they're understated and they're a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like, you
but
know,
this movie's not lurking, trying to be It Follows. This movie's not trying to be that. This movie's trying to be.
No. And like there's some good parts to it. I don't know. Maybe it's just, I just don't like Colin Farrell because David Tennant was, you're absolutely right on that. He's so good. Like when he's talking to his girlfriend, but also when he's talking to Charlie the first time and he's taking off his hair, he's taking off, he's wiping off the tattoos. He's just getting rid of the facade he is. And he's, you know what I mean? You can just see who he is beneath it. Right. And then eventually you get down to his realness. And I think that's good. There's a lot of depth in that character, but some of the other, and you know what, what did you think about the CGI in this film with the way the vampires looked in the 2011 version? I don't want to necessarily compare it to the makeup in the 85 version, but what did you think of like the way the vampires looked as they, you know,
when we start revealing how monstrous they really are?
Yeah, because
yeah,
I does think it make it a little silly? Yeah, or
for sure, it's yeah. it's not that bad, but it teeters into that video game territory of it doesn't look realistic. It doesn't look, and yes, it doesn't scare you because you're like, it's cartoonish, right? And
yeah, exactly. It's not effective, and it's like in its horror, which brings it back to the point: was this a date movie? Maybe it's not meant to be incredibly scary. Maybe it's just meant to be accessible, right?
And yeah, I think
they like wanted this to be a blockbuster hit, you know?
For sure.
That's probably why they were disappointed in how it actually did.
Yeah, they wanted to like crank up the awesome and turn down the suck. Like it was totally like over the top, big blowing things, blowing up, car chases, like fight scenes. Like it definitely, and like we were talking about with the, when we compared the two actors, Chris Sarandon, Colin Farrell, and it's the script too. So it's not on Colin Farrell, but like they make him into a real piece of shit, like all the time, every line. Like he's always like remember he has that speech with Charlie when he's trying to come into his house, and Charlie, he realizes I don't want to invite him in, and he's getting beers for him. So he's got him at the back door, but he's just not inviting him in. Colin Farrell keeps trying to like find ways to like come in, but you know, Charlie won't let him in. And so he gives him this whole speech about
women who look a certain way. They, they need to be managed. Your mom, she didn't exactly say, but there's a kind of neglect. Gives off a scent.
You know, your mom, you know, I can tell, I can smell it on her. She needs some affection. Like, as soon as you talk about a woman and start saying you can smell it on her.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're in the territory of real, like, scumbag.
Dirtbag.
Yeah, total dirtbag. And then he talks about his girlfriend, too. He's like,
and your girl, Amy, she's ripe. I bet there's a line of guys dying to pluck that. Your mom, too. You don't see it. Maybe you do, but she's putting it out.
She's ripe, you know? Like, isn't that the name of a porn mag? Like, this guy's just, like, scummy. And just, like, you got to protect them. You got to watch out because there's bad people out there. And it's like...
Yeah, you're one of them, man.
Yeah, and, like, why? What brought up this conversation? Nothing. It's just you being creepy. So...
Yeah, what was this? What was... It was the old... I got a girl over there, Charlie. I just, you know, I don't have any beers. Can you give me 6 Budweiser? So I can go, like, it's like, all right, man, there's better ways to, you know, like you got to work on your getting into the house game.
Also, you live in Nevada. Like the fucking grocery store's got beers, buddy.
Everyone's got beers, right? Yeah. Like in Ontario here, but.
No, but that movie takes place in Vegas. You tell me that you're not allowed to buy beers after 8 o'clock, whatever.
Yeah. Get it anywhere. Anyways. So. I don't know that we need to, you know, make a judgment on this, right? Who we like better. For me, I like Jerry better. For you?
For Jerry. Jerry's the character's name. You like
Chris Sarandon. Chris Sarandon. Yeah, I like him better. What about you?
I mean, I like him better in the sense that I like that type of vampire, whereas Colin Farrell represents, at least the new movie decided to take the vampire and make them more into monsters. So they're sort of like the things I like about vampires aren't as prevalent.
Yeah.
Instead, he's just super strong, super vicious, mean, you know.
But exactly, like you said, it goes from vampire to monster. Part of the, why do I like vampires? Does anybody like vampires? Because vampires are supposed to be intriguing and exotic and unknown and
ancient and like
they, ancient yeah
and they've hidden among us historical. All these years
yeah exactly and for me,
I think the first vampire stories relate back to the Bible, don't they? Like they're supposed to be like these sort of I've heard different versions of this, but I've heard versions of vampires that are sort of like the first humans that God made, and he kind of fucked up and they became these kind of like, you know, monsters. And like, you know, like there's Adam and Eve, but they were supposed to be Lilith before that. And some of the stories of Lilith, they've really monstrified her, and she's like raised this cult of like not quite humans. And
yeah,
you know, anyway, point being, they have there's a lot of different histories and ways you can approach the vampire myth.
Yeah.
And the Colin Farrell one, like, or, you know, we keep pitting on him. We shouldn't blame Colin Farrell.
No, exactly.
Writers of 2011 have sort of ignored all that. They've kept some of the basics of like, yeah, they don't like sunlight. They don't like crosses. They don't like garlic. But after that, it's just like, they're just kind of like these human-eating monsters. Now, at one point, Peter Vincent, in 2011 version, does say there are a certain kind of vampires. He calls them, do you remember what he called them? Like
no,
they live underground. He called them like, he had this grubbers, or he had some shitty, it was a weird name for them. But they're a type of vampire that's highly strong, sleeps in the dirt, underground, it lives in packs. And I forget what he called them, but
But that's clearly who Colin, the type that Colin Farrell was, right?
Yeah.
Because he had all the...
He's rebuilding his coven of vampires. And they're all in the dirt and all that.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe it was written that way because of the audiences of today, right? Where vampires can't be more subdued in character development, right? Or in their character traits, right? They need to be more like mean and monstrous and over the top and just aggro and all of it, you know, like... Maybe that's what it is, but
right. So maybe it's like what you said. Maybe because the Twilight vampire series had already was taking up so much space in people's minds at the time that they needed to find a different area of vampirism to play with.
Yeah, because those guys were the Vampire Diaries, Twilight. You know, they're vampires, but they're like cool, hip.
Yeah, they're emo, super teen drama. They still have some of that vampire mystery that we're talking about. Whereas, you know, Colin Farrell is just the total opposite of that. So, do you want to talk about another character?
Let's talk about Charlie, man. Let's talk about William Ragsdale and Chekhov.
Ensign Chekhov, Pavel Andreevich, sir.
Fine.
Yeah, Antoine Yelchin, right? Died, he died. Hey, yeah, you know, I was gonna say, R.I.P. Chekhov, Ensign. Star Trek with Chris Pine. I don't know what it is, man. You know, the new guy, I never believed that he could score a chick that looked like that, and his friends clearly didn't. And I never believed, to me, I just felt like, you know, like sometimes when something just doesn't pass the smell test and you can't really describe what it is other than just having like a gut feeling, which is not the best way to make decisions, but I'm watching him on screen and it just doesn't seem right for me. I don't know. He doesn't look anything like his mother. He has minimal chemistry with his girlfriend. He's got his old buddy and then he's got these new guys, which he's kind of playing this weird role with. I wasn't a huge fan of the new one. Yeah, I like the old one better. I don't know. I like the old one a lot better. I think he just kind of fit the role as like the younger, I'm snooping on my neighbor, kind of teen vigilante than the newer one. And like, then you totally lost me in the 2011 one where Charlie's in like the full Blade. Like leather fucking getup and he's got the crossbow and he's like looks ridiculous. You know, you lost me there.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.
What do you think?
I totally disagree. I am on the other side of this fence. I absolutely hated William Ragsdale.
Why?
Charlie Brewster. He is so annoying in this film. As soon as the first scene is done, he's just begging everyone, you gotta believe me. Come on. You gotta believe. And it's just like, shut the fuck up. Like, try another method, buddy. And it's the script too. He's forced to do the same thing over and over again, which is begging everyone to believe him and then being made a fool of. And he's just an idiot. Like, he's begging Peter Vincent, like every scene.
Well, he definitely, when you say idiot, I think to myself, there's like, I think probably the newer Charlie is maybe a little bit more, maybe a little smarter. The older
Charlie. He's a much more competent hero. Like the old Charlie's not a very competent hero. He's dumb.
This guy takes it upon himself to walk onto a neighbor, like trespasses onto a neighbor's property and go to open up the doors to the downstairs cellar, totally just out of the blue, right? Because he thinks he sees something. And then the other guy pops up and goes, hey, kid, what are you doing? And there's another time when I think he's looking out the window and he sees them moving a coffin or whatever it is. And then he decides he's going to come out to the backyard and like he's going to hide in this little small hedge that barely gives any privacy. Like, and then because the shot is like close, it looks like he's in like a fucking forest.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He's terrible. I just think he's not very smart. And by the way, major shout out to I'm trying to find on IMDb which guy he was. Like, what's the name of Jerry's sidekick? Who is the guy that hangs around his house all the time?
Oh my god, this is like Bill Pullman's like little brother.
Yeah,
that was like
is it Jonathan Stark? I'm looking at IMDb and they don't have a picture of him because I don't think he did much else. And Billy Cole, or is it Cook?
No, this was Billy Cole.
Billy Cole is the name of this Jerry psychic. So who, I love that character. I don't know who he is or what he's
purpose he serves. Rob, how can you love this character? This guy's
so
like,
creepy.
Actually, there's a huge issue with the movie with that character. Whoa. When Peter Vincent in the original looks in his
mirror.
In his mirror, he sees Peter Cole, but he doesn't see Jerry. However, it turns out that he's a psychic and he's also a vampire. Because
no,
he's
not a vampire. That's the point. He's not a vampire. He's actually something else. He's like a golem or something like that. He's a shell with like a monster like kind of living in him. Because we already know he can walk in the daylight. We see him in other times in the daylight. He's not a vampire.
What is he?
That's what I'm saying. He's like a golem. He's like a shell with some sort of monster that lives within him. Or he's like one of those, you know, like remember the Blade movies? They had those guys who had tattoos in their necks who were like servicing the vampires. And they're the hope that one day they'll bite them and turn them for them. But they've
kind
to,
of been, yeah. They're not of this world as well, right? They're some kind of being. Well,
in Blade, they're just humans that are servicing the vampires.
Yeah, but in this like, one, this guy's vampire. Clearly like, he's clearly, you know, and he's a sidekick.
And he's clearly, creepy. Yeah, Every line he says is so creepy. He's so weird. I love that dude.
No, the best is when he comes, Charlie. Yeah. So you know what? You're kind of convinced. You know, you're not going to convince me that because I liked him better just because I'm probably more nostalgic about the
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I don't know how you liked him though.
But
everything he said annoyed me.
Because it's just because he gives a sense of urgency to the film, right? Like, if there was a vampire next door to your house, would you be playing like the subdued character? Or would you be fucking freaking out and trying to get anybody that would listen?
No, I get that, but it runs its course pretty quick. Whereas like Anton Yelich, he's actually even braver. Like you said, the other guy.
Yeah, but it all comes off like not like he's
brave.
Yeah,
but it's a different kind of movie. Movie's trying to be an action, fun, over the top adventure. It's not trying to be a subtle horror movie vampire thing, which I think is the problem. It may be that you're finding here is that, you know, Fright Night 2011 isn't really trying to be a full remake of the old one.
And maybe that's what it is. Maybe
it wants to be its own thing.
It's false advertising. Best part, shout out to Die Hard. Shout out to Art Evans. William Ragsdale decides that he's going to call the police to come in. That's one of the great scenes with Bob Cole. No, he's an announcer for
Hockey Night Canada.
Hockey Night Canada. Oh, baby. Jim Cole or whatever. Jerry's buddy. When he comes in and he's got the police and Charlie's like, check the coffin.
That's what's down there. A coffin. I saw them carry it in.
What?
And you'll find Jerry Dandridge in it, sleeping the sleep of the undead.
Ooh. What are you talking about?
He's a vampire.
Uh-oh.
I saw him in that room last night, and he had fangs, and he bit her on the neck.
For heaven's sake, come on.
What are you talking about? Wait. Look, we can't just leave like this.
I've got a coffin for you. Look,
I'm telling you, Jerry Dandridge is a vampire.
Sure, and I'm dirty hearing. Now, let me tell you something, kid. If I ever catch your ass down at the station house again, I'm throwing it in jail forever.
Then the police officer is talking with Jerry's sidekick there, and then he just looks like a total fool. That guy was in Die Hard 2.
Art Evans. Yeah.
Art Evans, fantastic actor. I just wanted to shout him out. I thought he did a nice job. But...
Okay, here's the other thing I don't like about William Ragsdale, and it's not even his fault. I'm a big fan of the movie Gremlins, which we are going to do on this goddamn podcast one day, probably for Christmas.
Yeah, Ragsdale was like the main dude there.
No, it's a different actor. Billy is played by a different guy in Gremlins, but these two guys are styled identically. They both dress the same way. And in my mind, kids in the 80s, did they actually dress like that? Like he's wearing like a button-up shirt under a sweater all the time with like slacks.
Dude, have you not fucking seen Flight of the Navigator?
No, I've seen the movies, but in real life, kids did not dress like miniature versions of their dads. Like the styling, it's just so. Anyway, he's so square that you want Jerry to fuck his girlfriend the whole movie. You're like, yeah, take it from this guy.
But it seems so like that's the thing. It seems, I guess in. It seems like he's never got a chance because he's like this high school kid. And then Jerry is like, I don't know how old he's supposed to be.
But he's like 500 years old or something.
No, but yeah, but he's like, he's like 40.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's supposed to be like 38 to 44. Yeah, for sure. You know what I mean? Like in that in that, you know, age range, right? So he doesn't really have a chance. It definitely feels pretty asymmetrical, like it's an adult versus a kid, which probably is the reason why he needs help from Peter Vincent. But I think, okay, so we're pretty divided on the Charlies. What about the sidekicks? We're talking about McLovin. I had to go back and look at the
clip Mintz from Place.
Yeah, Mintz Place.
Is that how you say it?
Place. I had to look at the super bad clip where he's buying the the beer, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm trying to cut back." Or
yeah. Does that not remind you of our friend Yek, who at age 16 we sent into a beer store in like some small ass country town? And because he's half Japanese, we're like, they're never going to ID him because they have no idea how old he is. He goes in and we're all laughing from the car, waiting to see him get rejected. He comes out with a 2-4 on his shoulders, just walking it out. Like, we just start howling, laughing. Like, this guy comes out with a champ with a 2-4 over his shoulder.
Oh my God. That was 16 years old. That was one of like, just like, you know, you plant your flag.
Yeah. That's one of Yik's proudest moments for sure.
What's he accomplished since?
All right. So McLovin, yeah.
So McLovin, right? Evil. Evil. Now, Evil. Okay. Hands down. I think we're talking Jeffries, right? Like
Stephen Jeffries is the actor.
Stephen Jeffries, right? So for some reason, because he had like that high pitched, like laugh and like,
oh, you're so cool, Brewster.
Charlie, like yeah, you know, like he's got that high
there all the time.
I thought he had other credits. Like, I feel like I've heard that before. And then I went to look, and this guy had this was it.
Yeah.
This Fright Night was it. No, Fright Night was it for this guy. But there's a couple of scenes that are just fucking gold with this guy. The one scene is when he's running. First off, he gives Charlie all the information about how to kill the vampire, right? He gives him the cross and says, here you go, but you got to have faith. And then he gives him all the links of garlic, right? When he goes to Evil as like a confidant, right? And then Evil eventually, you know, they're out one night and they get separated, and Evil is actually turned into a vampire by Jerry, right? Mm-hmm. And I love that scene. He's like running through. It reminds me of all these old 1980s films that are all like these urban sets, you know what I mean, like the Batmans, where there's a smoke, there's like mm-hmm. so much fog, you mm-hmm. know what I mean, like it's a super foggy day, and he's running down all these empty alleys, and then Jerry finally gets him and then pulls the cloak over him and turns into a vampire. Anyways,
but remember, Jerry doesn't get him. Jerry offers him.
He says some Rob,
like, no, but he says to him like, he is, I know what it's like to be different. This is what I'm talking about, how I don't necessarily view Jerry in the old movie as a strict villain. Like, he, yes, he's vampire and he's turning people into vampires, but like,
Rob, he's a manipulator.
Yeah, but Evil is a weird kid who doesn't get along with many other people. People find him annoying because of his crazy, weird, high-pitched voice and annoying face and weird haircut.
But hold on. At what point in the movie did you ever see this guy battling with like a lack of buddies and a lack of social standing?
That's true. They don't illustrate it, but I feel like you get it just from listening to them.
Well, they're just gonna take the shortcut there, and he's just gonna say that, and then you're gonna have to believe, probably because you can read into just his mannerisms and whatnot. Anyways, he turns into a vampire. It's fantastic. He goes up to Peter Vincent's house, trying to get him after he's in the play, and Vincent hits him with the cross. But the best thing is that he jumps out the window. You know what that, and like full on.
I like the cross burns his forehead. He's got his X in his forehead for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it's like right there, like boom. But he jumps out the window. You know what it reminded me of? You ever seen the movie Little Giants with Ed O'Neill, the little football movie?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Oh my God, you got to watch that movie. It reminds me when Ed O'Neill is showing the kids how to tackle a dummy, and he tackles one of the kids and then goes flying out the second floor window of the house and then goes down. Just totally reminded me of that. But evil was good, and evil had a lot of stage presence because he's different because he had like that high pitched laugh. I feel like Charlie's character, first off, I feel like he could have done more with his buddy, but one of the plot deviations, and like this brings in a question, is it really a remake? Is that really quickly in the movie does he turn? Mm-hmm. It's not until about an hour, 55 minutes into the film, does evil get turned. And when he gets turned, that's when you start to see the that second half of the old film kind of go. So, you know, Ed, did it make a huge impact on me? You know, it was kind of like he comes back when they're in Peter Vincent's, you know, like you said, like he has that museum of all those old artifacts and he's trying to kill Charlie. But to me, it was never super impactful. I mean, wasn't a huge fan of him. Did you like him?
I liked how he was set up, that, you know, they had this conflict, that the movie begins with them in conflict, like, you know, in 2011, we're talking about the 2011 one here, that right away, Charlie has become the cool kid already. We didn't see that happen, but then we learned that he wasn't the cool kid, and now he's left Ed behind, which makes you think like, hey, Charlie, that's shitty. And so part of, you know, Charlie's story is going to be sort of, you think it's going to be about reconnecting with his old friend making good on what he did wrong. But instead he has to kill him. And in a way, it's like burying the past. But you're right. Like, Ed's story is sort of not fully connected and not fully fleshed out. Instead, Ed just becomes a vengeful friend, a vengeful former friend who now is after him, and basically gets dispatched of as soon as you meet him. Like, I mean, it's a long fight scene, or it's a long scene, but like, he basically just does get killed. He doesn't he doesn't really affect the plot in any other way.
No, that's exactly right.
Except that he attacks them right at Peter Vincent's home, which then allows them to recruit Peter Vincent, which they didn't have until that point. Ed, in the other one, in the original, he also has a unique ability that when he transforms as a vampire, he also can turn into a wolf, which is really nice. And this is the interesting thing about the Fright Night original, is that like, we think of it as a vampire film, but like I said, his Jerry's buddy is actually some sort of golem. Ed is actually some sort of maybe werewolf or vampire, but he's something like, there's more to the vampirism. They like really play with it in ways that there's more monsters in the movie. Yeah. So, cause like in a way there's three unique monsters that I can think of.
Yeah.
And then, by the way, when Ed gets killed by Peter Vincent in the 85, did you put the timer on for this? This death scene lasts, I think, at least 3.5 minutes. The moment that he actually stabs him with the stake from the staircase and they fall over the edge, it's like 3 minutes before Ed actually dies. You have to watch him transform, and you have to watch Peter Vincent's face in horror, and this drags on forever.
Yeah, like I couldn't tell if this was an actual, because, you know, I'll preface this by saying Peter Vincent, the older, like Roddy McDowell's guy, when he's watching him, his facial expressions literally go through like the pantheon of expressions, right? It made me think like, oh, what is this? Are we trying to be like The Room, or are we trying to actually add some drama to this plot?
Oh no, here, yeah, right? Like, trying to add drama. Like he's
like, do you want the audience to empathize with this character, right? Are we supposed to feel sad for him?
There is a moment where you're supposed to feel sad because he returns back to human state, and Peter Vincent sort of like is like, oh, what a waste. Like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, he's going through all that in this 3 minute like montage between body shifting blood and Peter Vincent face. It's an interesting scene in a weird way, but it is exceptionally long. I can't put my finger on what the thought process was here, but
yeah.
And the other thing is, but I'll put to you though, too, like, you know, we don't love McLovin in the 2011, but what's the so what on Ed? So Ed dies, so what?
Yeah. Like both of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like he passes away, and that's kind of it.
The only thing I'm get out of Ed is a little illusion that maybe he came back at the very end. At the very end of the movie, we see eyes in the old house that the vampire lived in, that Jerry lived in.
Do you think that's Ed?
I think it's Ed. But I never saw the sequel, so I have no idea.
Yeah, it might be. I don't know. Okay, so the Vampire Hunter. I think you're right. That this is where the nostalgia train comes to the final stop for me. And I like the new guy better. The older guy, you know, they're you're right. Like, did he own it? Did he sell it? Like how those, you know, we think about Westridge down in Anaconda.
He's very Westridge, isn't he?
Like the Brit twits. But the new guy is awesome. He's just like fucking drinking and being rude and... Oh.
Leather, it don't breathe, you know. Fucking rashes are fucking killing me.
Just, but then sheds that. So it shows that there's a lot to his personality, right? Like he's projecting based on trauma that he's had in the past.
Yeah, which they expose. They never tell us that.
Yeah, about, yeah, but that's really good because that makes a lot of sense. You know what I mean? At least for me in my experience, when there's... You know, when there's hidden trauma, a lot of times there's outward behaviors that mask everything. And then for that character to be written that way makes it just, me and you always talk about, like, does it make sense? Can we figure out the rules? Can we figure out the boundaries? Is the writing clever? Is it complete? And for him, he made a lot of sense to me in the film. His character, the way that was written, the way that was, and then he was scared too.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty natural reaction, right? Like he didn't want to do it. What did he say? He goes, you know, I'm just going to tell you, mate, we're going to survive, you know, we're going to survive. But like eventually he realizes that he's got to friggin' step up. He's got to avenge Colin Farrell. It ends up that he's the one that killed his parents.
Yeah. I didn't love that addition.
No, you know what?
It's convenient.
It's too convenient. And it's too easy. That's too easy. Be a little bit more, ask more yourself and ask more of the audience. You know what I mean? Because how many people are going to be like, oh my God, that was such a great twist.
No,
it wasn't.
It doesn't pay off at all.
It doesn't, because it's just, you're right. You said it's just too, you use convenient. I say easy. Just expect more of your audience. Right. So, but I liked him anyways.
You know what would have been creepier? Like, and this is, I don't know how you write this, because I don't know if this is a good plan or not. Instead of Colin Farrell being the vampire that killed his parents, what if he was one of like the kids of the vampire that killed the parents? So like he talks about Peter Vincent's parents as just being like food. Like my parents fed that to me. Like I'm a
little baby bird in a nest.
Yeah. What I mean? Make it creepier. Just add a little twist to it like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But like, again, something simple like that, right? Rob, now that we've looked at the characters, I want to kind of shift over to a really quick look at some of the horror tropes in here, right? Because in the older one, a lot of them are really prevalent. And after doing Hereditary and working with a movie with the director that's, you know, specifically subverted some of those horror tropes, it was really interesting to go back and look at a film. And I want to just highlight a couple of examples, right? The one and the biggest one, and I'm going to bring it back, Rob, and I'm going to ask you to cue this in the drops when we actually get this out for the listeners here, is Ari Aster talked about when he had Colin Stetson do the score, that he wanted the score to kind of be its own character. He wanted to move away from having music that was identifiable with specific characters. Okay, if you go back and listen to Fright Night 1985, the music that is played every time you see Derry Jandrich, like the
it's you like a piggy man.
It's like good.
I was waiting for the dung dung from the Law and Order theme song. Like
it's just like it was so good, the idea of that movie that's associated with the heavy. Because really for the first it loses at the end because they all come together and like the kind of the big climax, they're inside the house. But you've got just that music that comes every time, which is amazing. Second thing is, come on, is that not just the best fucking haunted house you've ever seen in your entire life? Like old creepy home.
Yeah, so remember you were talking about the poster at the beginning, and it really focuses on the vampires like you know, crazy face with these weird snake, almost like Medusa-like hair, but it's over the house. And it was weird to me, like, because when I went back to watch it, I didn't remember the house being such a core part of it. And yeah, it really is. It's all about this vampire's moved into this house and it's become a haunted vampire house in your suburban neighborhood.
Yeah. And I don't think, and like the one in the 2011 is just one that, you know, this guy's got like the Inquirer up on his windows to block out the light. But this guy has, you know, literally this old Victorian house that when you go into it, it's filled with clocks and stuffed owls and, you know what I mean? Beavers and all these kind of like really cool things. Like it's amazing, right? It's just so good. Right. So those were two things. And this third one is not necessarily a horror trope, but more, you know, paying not homage, but just paying respects to the era in which it was, you know, crafted in, is, you know, just to bring it back, how good the dance scene was, but more the music with it. Yeah. So it's, what is it? A Good Man in a Bad Time by Ian Hunter. Go back and listen to that song. Rob, right now, cue it. How good is that tune? And just as, you know, it's like the pop tune, it's like the soundtrack tune to brand Jerry. So you've got the music, like his heavy music when he comes in, but then you've got this like pop tune that brands him as well. It's like so good. So for me, I just love those aspects of, you know, I love those aspects of the film. And I wanted to just make a point of those. Is there anything, you know, kind of just on the periphery or just anything specific that you really liked about either film that's kind of in like the filming or the music or anything kind of not in character, not in plot that you enjoy that you want to kind of bring up?
I think you've nailed the ones that I'm really interested in. The dance scene is so amazing. It's so funny to me. I can't believe it's not like a meme. I can't believe like Saturday Night Live hasn't done a parody of it yet. You know, like, you know how like the saxophone guy from The Lost Boys. There's a scene where they go to like a concert and there's this guy playing saxophone. He's ripped. He's sweaty. He's got no shirt on and he's got leather pants and he's just like hilarious. Like he's such an 80s icon. He used to play with Tina Turner. He's actually like a really well-known musician, but like it's just such a funny image. And they took that image and they made it into this joke where every time this guy like feels this breeze, John Hamm dressed as this guy explodes through the wall, just blasting the saxophone. It's so funny because it just keeps interrupting all these parts of his life until yeah, I don't want to ruin the punchline. You guys should look this up. It is so funny. It's one of my favorite skits. Thank you. Anyway, this scene is ripe for that kind of parody, this kind of joke, because it's so, it's a long scene again, back to the amount of time they spend on these scenes. It's a full dance number. And this is where Marcy.
It's two songs, dude. It's three songs.
This is where Marcy is essentially seduced and again gives herself to the vampire to say, okay, take me home. Like, let's make this happen.
Yeah.
So I love that. Do you want to talk the special effects? How about let's go. Green ooze at the end.
Well, Bob Cole, Bob Cole.
Oh, baby.
For those of you
who are not Canadian, Bob Cole is like an iconic hockey broadcaster. And he's a pretty old guy now, but he had like some really amazing catchphrases.
He's like 96.
Yeah. But when guys would score goals, he had so many catchphrases. And the one that most people know him for is, oh, baby.
Oh, baby. The best was, you know, he was the first guy that I realized that would just say, you know, and Lemieux is over the line. You know what I mean? Like he didn't say the blue line. He just said over the line. So you knew he was over the line. into the zone, but just little things like that.
Well, he was good at just keeping the energy going, because he'd say things like, look at him now, look at him go.
He's the best. That's he's the
he's
best
not describing what's happening at all. He's just he's just like pure energy. I loved it. Anyway, moving on.
The special effects. Cool. The special effects were pretty good. So
what'd you what'd you think of the vampires though? Like in 85, when Jerry is full bloom monster vampire, what'd you think?
I actually think it's really good. And I think one of the cool things is when he changes into the bat.
Oh yeah.
So he changes into the bat. No, but like it reminds me of, I don't know, like I feel like we should have done some research into it, and maybe we should come back and maybe put this into the notes, or if we circle back and maybe can add something like an appendium to it, where to me there was like a guy in the 80s, like maybe working with like Labyrinth, all these fantasy horror films that were doing these crazy, you know, mechanical figures that were all like kind of horrific, and the makeup artist, right? I feel like there's a guy, I've seen a documentary, I just can't remember the name, but I actually thought that bat looks pretty good. I thought Jerry looked pretty scary, man, with the eyes and then with his face, and just, you know, like he gets full blown. And the fact is it's not CGI. So there's a, you know, a hint of realism that's with it. You know, it's meant to be scary, not meant to be perfect. When you see the newer films and the CGI take over, to me, it just loses a lot of the humanity. And I know you're saying, well, it's not supposed to be humanity, it's a vampire, but it's also supposed to be someone whose vampires aren't supposed to, when you look traditionally, right, they're not supposed to like completely like morph themselves into like, or maybe they are, but I thought the special effects were really good. I thought Billy Cole, when the green slime starts coming down his foot and then he just totally disintegrates, made me think of like Raiders of the Lost Ark, eh? When
the guy melts.
When he met, like the whole melting scene, when it's like pretty gross, but really good. And I think that was a thing back in the 80s to see like the, you know, the time lapse melt scene, you know, at least it seemed like it, because you would never see that today. You would never see that kind of gore on a front shot just kind of melt away. I think that was what classified as like shock and awe back in 85.
It's funny, even the new movie, and even if you go a little further to like the Avengers movies, like I feel like the trope today, instead of like oozy slime, is like disintegrate into dust and blow away in the wind.
Yeah.
That's the thing you see now with the CGI, because it's easier to do with the particle effects to make it blow away and just like disintegrate.
To me, like, you know, that's
Avengers made it affecting, but in this one, in this 2011, when the girl gets smoked, it's sudden and it's shocking, but at the same time, it's like, it's not like.
I think it made me just appreciate like the idea of like a good bit of gore, because there's, you know, as another subgenre of horror films, right? Like, you know, you've got like the gore, and you don't see that in a lot of newer horror movies, at least not some of the ones that I've seen. I'm sure they're out there. And there's a million movies and they're made all the time, but you just don't see like that kind of gore, blood and slime and nastiness. Right. So I thought that was good. But you know, even in the newer one, right. Like, even though I'm not a huge fan of the CGI, there was some like very vicious, teeth on the female vampires. Right. You know, the mouths get a little bit bigger and it just like, reminds me of like, you know, what's that movie with the plant, with the fucking plant that wants to kill you in the teeth?
Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, Little Shop of Horrors, man. Yeah.
Rick Moranis. Feed me, Seymour.
Feed me all night long. It's no mechanical snake, Rob, but.
All right, Jamie, let's wrap this up. Let's get to our rating.
All right, let's rate this. Let's rate this baby up.
So how are we going to do this? Because we got the two films. Are you going to rate one and the other, or are you going to do like the Fright Night experience, or how you want to do it?
I'm going to rate the first one. I'm going to rate the second one. Okay. And you know what? We've been on this for a while. Okay. So the new one, you're right. Like a cranked up, amped up version. It's like the Fast and the Furious version of Fright Night. I wasn't a huge fan of Colin Farrell. I thought Ed was, you know, there was something a little bit left to be desired there. Imogene Potts, I thought, was like a very good looking actress, played the character really well. And I loved Peter Tennant. I loved his version of, I thought he was the best part, because I thought he had the most fulsome character, best character arc, had a bit of backstory. They wrote it in nicely. Wasn't a huge fan of Anson Chekhov, but I was generally entertained, even though I texted you halfway through on my second watch going, man, this fucking movie sucks. So I'm giving it 2.5 footsteps for the later one. For the 1985 one, listen, this movie is eternally connected to my childhood, my love of my grandparents. I topped the pot off just with that. I think that Chris Sarandon was like pretty good. Evil was legit. You know, Roddy McDowell on the Peter Vincent, you know, that was a miss. We can't make them all. And it had this whole, like, if you've ever seen the movie The Burbs, it just kind of has this unsettling yet familiar feeling of being in the suburbs. And like, it could happen to anybody. I wasn't as, you know, which I thought is really good. It's got an everyman sense of kind of self, the movie. William Ragsdale, you've kind of moved me towards the he's annoying kind of guy.
I hated him.
I'm going to go, I think for me, this is 4 footsteps out of 5. So just to recap, the 2011 for me is 2.5 out of 5 footsteps. And the 1985 version is 4 footsteps out of 5. But the Fright Night experience, I am a fan of the Fright Night experience. So 2 thumbs up for both films from Jamie Roberts, Running Scared. Rob, what do you think?
Thumbs? We can't do thumbs. What the fuck are you talking about? You should have made them like at least like zombie thumbs or something.
Two toes up.
Two toes. Okay, so I guess I'll start with 2011, because that's where you started. I found this movie pretty entertaining. It's definitely got holes, plot holes. It's definitely like ridiculous. But because I'd already seen the 85 ones, I was expecting that. And I was just sort of waiting to see where they would take that element of it being a bit ridiculous. And like I said, their attitude was, all right, let's just crank it up to 11. Let's make this the most, like, you know, over the top crazy action version of a Fright Night. I think you do lose some fun of the whole vampire genre when you turn the vampire into like strictly a misogynist, you know, dirtbag monster, and not really a vampire. He's not mysterious. He's not interesting. He's actually very basic. He like probably, you know, they literally show him watching TV at one point, and it's like the girl on TV says, I'm thinking about getting breast implants. And he's just like, hey, 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 hey. So like they totally keep making him scummier and scummier. And then you find out that he's keeping people trapped in his basement. And if you're going to go there, like that's that like girl with the dragon tattoo kind of villain. That villain was shocking, and also like more sinister, because he's such an intelligent businessman, and like you're like, why would this man be like that? And then they explain it, which is what I like that story. But like in this one, there's nothing extra to it. He's just, oh, he's building a new coven, is what you kind of find out later via Peter Vincent. But I don't know. I do think, Jamie, you got to give more credit for the house things. Like, I know you love the house setting in the old one, but I do think they explained why Colin Farrell is who he is. He's a construction worker. And that's why he was doing all that work in the house, because he was digging the concrete out of the basement so he could build his like fortress, his like, you know, place for vampires to live, his cave or whatever. So I think I like the explanation of like, it's Vegas. It's a lot of transient population. There's a lot of people work at night. So I thought they like clicked a few things. I did like the cast a lot more, although I do think McLovin wasn't used enough, and they should have paid that off in more, like a little stronger. I did obviously I loved our Peter Vincent, the new one. So entertained. Overall, I'm entertained. It's just a dumb movie. So if you like a dumb movie that's like just going to click along at a high speed pace and with lots of, you know, energy and action, it's fun. But I'm with you. I'm going to give this one 2.5 footsteps.
Ooh, look at that. I was surprised.
I was going to go a little higher, but then I thought, you know, it's just a dumb movie though. Like it's dumb, but yeah, it's the fun. Writing... It's fun.
Okay.
It's is fun. It now? Is it as fun as Fright Night 1985? No, I think Fright Night 85 is, well, actually that's a tough one because it depends on your taste. Cause like going back to those 80s movies, it's hard for someone who's, you know, younger than us because they're just like, this movie plods along. Like, it'll be slow to them, right? And, like, I think Charlie is annoying.
But hold on. I don't think...
Oh, this is my rating section. This is where I get to say what I think. I think it's slow. You've got a death scene that takes 3 minutes. You've got a dance scene that takes 5 minutes. What I love about Fright Night is that opening scene. And like you said, that where he looks at the window and he sees the vampire and like, it's all like baked in this like titillation of like, oh my goodness, these two are about to fuck. Oh, he's going to bite her. And then window goes down. Right. So it plays with your like sensations in different ways. It's a fun premise. Like you said, kid in the suburbs, this could happen to anyone. New neighbor moves in and they turned out to be a horrible monster. So I love that premise. I think where I take things off is I had a hard time dealing with Charlie. Peter Vincent wasn't that exciting to me, but like, he comes along eventually, but you know, he never seems like a threat on the side of good. He's just like, he has some weapons, but he's also like kind of a frail old man. I did love Marcy, that she did a great job, especially when she turns and they do her hair up like all crazy. And the end scene is pretty fun when he's full monster and they're breaking the windows and all that. So I would give Fright Night 1985 3.5 steps.
Okay. So you know what? We were the same on 2011. We got really close on the older one. The one thing I will say is that you were really having issues with the older Halloween. The fact that it was just like, you said to me like, my God, is anything going to happen? I never felt, or I guess the question is, did you feel like that with this Fright Night movie?
No.
Because I didn't. When I watch it, I'm still entertained. Like, me too. I still feel like it's got good pacing.
That's exactly what I was about to say. It has momentum, and it all starts with that opening scene. Halloween wanted to scare you off the bat in a like a bone chilling way, and they started that with the music and the font and the title. Whereas this movie like starts you off like, oh, it's a teenage romance, and then like, boom. Something weird happens and it's like,
yeah.
It catches you. It's got a great hook and every scene.
Exactly. That's it. It's a good hook.
Yeah. And every scene kind of builds on that. So, honestly, I thought of it. It's actually like the bumps for me are when evil enters and you have to deal with his shrill voice, but I like him as a character. I like how he gets turned. I like that he offers to be turned, like where he sort of gives in. I also like how Marcy, I keep calling her Marcy, but it's Amy. I love how Marcy,
Amanda Bruce.
Yeah, but how she submits finally to the vampire. So like, I love that this vampire doesn't actually have to go around like murdering people. People like kind of volunteer to be turned.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. Okay, Rob. So this was good. This was fun to do. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed doing the Fright Night. You know what I mean? It's a great one from our youth, and to bring in the newer one was a great idea. So listen, anybody out there that wants to send us a message, therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter @runningscaredpd. If you want to follow us on Instagram @runningscaredpod. And again, if you just want to talk to us, send us a quick email. That would be fantastic. One of the things you might want to check out if you're still listening to the podcast at this stage is we've got a great Patreon. You can sign up for Slasher Mode right now. For $15, you get our top tier forever. So that's only open to the first 15 people that decide to join that.
Yeah, that's a discounted rate too.
Discounted rate, lots of goodies, lots of excellent stuff. And you know what we're going to do? If you've stuck with us and you're with us at the end of this pod, first person to send us an email, we're going to send you out a Running Scared t-shirt. Okay, so send us a quick little email. Let me know where your name is and where you're from. And we're going to get that t-shirt shipped out to you right away just for being a loyal listener. Rob, I think we've got a couple of things coming up. We've got our second Jogcast, which looks like it's going to be coming out relatively soon, which ironically enough is a story that revolves around vampires entitled Blood at Night. Really excited about that. We have heard nothing but really good positive things about the Jogcast. A lot of people are listening to them. A lot of people are running with them, which is amazing. We're going to keep making them. Okay. So, you know what I mean? Just continue to enjoy those. And then I think you're going to see Hereditary at some point, hopefully.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So we got it recorded. We're still fighting with it. And it's a tough film. And yeah, like for those of you who've seen it, like there's so much to unpack and to think about. So anyway, we will get to that. A couple other things we want to get to is The Descent. We're going to get to that one soon.
So is that, you know what, are we calling it right now? Is that the next one we're doing?
I wasn't going to call it, but I was going to leave it wide open for us to figure that out later off pod.
Okay,
but,
sure, yeah.
Also, we got to do something for Halloween, James, so we got to start planning for that one.
We do,
and,
yeah.
I've already started planning for this one, but I haven't started building it out yet. But I want to do a special edition called Kids Week, where we're going to look at like what does horror mean for young audiences, and then that's going to help us talk about like what is the horror genre when it's you're not allowed to show violence, when you're not allowed to have gore. So, sort of what is the gateway to horror is kind of what that's going to be about. And so, me and Jamie are both talking to our kids about that right now because they're little. But we're also going to review some interesting stuff on that one.
All right, Rob, this has been a fantastic night. So from everybody at Running Scared, thank you. And we'll see you next time on Running Scared.
The Running Scared podcast is written and produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts. Edited by Robert Lendrum.
Reach out to us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and we'll see you next time on Running Scared.
That wasn't the only murder. Get this. Both of them had their heads chopped off.
You're sick.